Mystery Theater. Behind that door is a clue to a strange expedition that did, in fact, set out from Edmonton in 1934, out into the cold. For what? Perhaps we shall never know. Some who remember say it was the folly of a millionaire French count. Some others say there was more to it than that, something strange, even sinister. Our version of the expedition is as author Otto Lowy imagines it to have been. From CBC Winnipeg, Champagne Safari. Production and direction, Tony Ross. Champagne Safari.
Yes, sir?
I'm sorry to trouble you, but I'd hoped the museum would be open today.
Oh, it was, sir.
Was?
Yes, sir.
But it is Sunday, isn't it? And museums usually are open on Sundays. At least all the museums I've ever seen were.
Oh, so is this one, sir.
But this is Sunday, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Sunday. 6 p.m. The museum closes at 5.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Too bad.
We open up at 10 a.m. tomorrow.
I'm afraid that won't be much use to me. I'm catching the 9 a.m. plane to Vancouver.
Oh, well, why don't you get the afternoon flight? I think
it's no use. I have to make the Vancouver connection to catch the polar flight.
Oh,
I have to be back in London Tuesday morning.
Oh.
I say, any chance of...
Oh, what the heck. Why don't you come in?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Through that glass door.
Thank you.
I'm sorry if I seemed a bit officious out there, but you see, this is my first job.
And... Your first job?
Yes. I'm a first-year history student at the University of Saskatchewan, and I thought I'd better make some money this year.
Well, as a history student, you got a job in the right place, in a museum.
Yes, I guess I was pretty lucky. I'm sorry, sir. All I do is talk about myself and my job.
No, that's all right. I did ask you, you know.
Well, you see, I've only been here a week, and... Is there anything you particularly want to see? The whole of the West's here. From ladies' combs to the iron horses of the plains.
I've come to have a look at your lorry.
Lorry?
Yes, a truck. A French truck. A sort of tractor, really. A Citroen.
Oh, now, just a minute, Mr.
Gray. John Gray.
Pleased to meet you, sir. My name is Bruce Rogers. I'm...
Yes, I know.
Of course. Now, about that truck. There's a small annex out the back. A sort of garage, really. But it is part of the museum.
That might be what I'm looking for.
Oh, it probably is, too. Charlie promised to show me the stuff next week. He knows a lot about that truck. There must be something special about it.
Well, Mr. Rogers, it's getting a bit late, and if you don't mind, perhaps we could have a look at that annex and what it contains.
Well, I'd like to oblige. I only hope Charlie won't mind.
I feel almost certain he won't object. Perhaps a donation to the museum fund.
Oh, no, sir. Charlie would do anything for anyone who's interested in the prairies. It's not really necessary, sir.
Well, shall we go, then?
Okay, then, Mr. Gray. This way. Hmm. Hinges need oiling.
I don't suppose you get many tourists asking for the annex.
Not a single one since I started working here. Wait a minute. I better switch on the light. Oh, I'm not surprised. Why? It's just a truck. An old truck.
Yes, an old truck.
But it's a museum piece, all right. Why, I bet any collector of vintage cars would give his eye teeth to get his hands on this one.
Yes. Yes, that's it. That's it, all right.
What? What is it?
Well, Mr. Rogers, what you're looking at is a 1932 model Citroën truck made in France.
And what's that got to do with the history of Western provinces? Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to...
No, that's all right, Mr. Rogers. A good question, as one of your professors would undoubtedly say. But it has something to do with the history of the Western provinces, you know. And if it hadn't been for... I'll tell you something, Mr. Rogers. You make me a cup of coffee, and I, in return, will tell you something about the mystery of that old Citroën. My bus back to Edmonton isn't due until later tonight. Who knows? You might find my story interesting.
Coffee okay?
Splendid. Isn't this what they call real Western hospitality?
You're English, aren't you, sir?
Yes. 1967 seemed to be a good year to visit Canada. Or I should say revisit.
Oh, you've been here before, sir?
Well, yes, once in 1934. I thought I'd like to come back once more. And when I discovered you had the old Citroën here, I thought I might as well stop over here on my way home. Yes, 1934. It's a strange year. Strange time for us in England, in Europe. I won't talk about the unemployment and the hunger. You went through all that over here. Well, not you, of course. You hadn't even been born yet. And most of the revolutions, the quiet ones and the loud ones, were a direct result of that hunger, of that despair in the year 1934. And from across the channel, the voice of the turtle, as well as the roar of the lion, could be heard in England, in London. And one of those voices, the loudest of them, could be heard that spring night in 1934 over the radio in many English houses. And it was heard and listened to that night in a heavily carpeted and paneled office on the top floor of a building in London.
Drink, Gray?
Thank you, sir.
Whiskey?
Yes, sir.
I'll have one with you. I need it after this particular performance. There you are.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted you to hear that speech, Gray.
Yes?
I don't think you'd have listened.
I don't think so, sir, no. You see,
I know you'd have been down at the club relaxing. A little baccarat, maybe?
Well, sir,
I know you've just come back and deserve a rest. No reason for you to listen to that maniac.
No, sir.
Have you ever been to Canada, Gray?
No, sir, never.
Well, in that case, you might find this job even more interesting than I think it is. Nothing like a bit of sightseeing on the side, I always say.
I'm afraid, sir, in my 5 years with you, I've found very little time for sightseeing. Unless, of course, you call the Roman sewers a tourist attraction.
I see. You're referring in your customary oblique way to your last assignment. Well, Gray, I've probably omitted telling you, and I apologize, that the minister himself was highly pleased with your report on the activities in the Eternal City. He asked me to convey to you his
personal congratulations.
And you're telling me this now? Now, when you're about...
When I'm about to send you out into the cold again, if you'll forgive the phrase.
Very apt.
Now, come, Gray, you know better than that. You know I don't have to reward you first in order to ask you to take on another job.
Do you mind if I have another drink, sir?
Of course not, my dear boy. Help yourself.
Thanks.
Tell me, Gray, have you ever heard the expression B-unit?
B-unit? No, sir. But I'll check on the files in the organizations connected
with... I'm afraid you'll find nothing on the B-unit in our files, Gray. But the London School of Economics might supply you with the answer. An unlikely source for our kind of work, I grant you. The B-unit was invented by a man called Bidot. And he made a packet out of it. Clever chap and all that, I grant you. Came from France to the United States shortly before World War I. His first job after landing in New York with a few dollars in his pocket was as an itinerant waiter earning $9 a week. He soon put two and two together and came up with a very clever little system that was in the early 20s to earn him labor's undying hatred. It also netted him untold millions, making him the leader of a fashionable international set, friend of many barons, ambassadors, and princes, whom he entertained with regal splendor in his magnificent French chateau. Here's a picture of it.
Handsome place.
Yes. Quite a nice little place for a friendly game of baccarat, eh, Gray? Now, this is what Monsieur Bidot looks like. Have a good look at him. I have a feeling you'll be seeing a great deal of him.
Not a bad face. You'd be kind enough to tell me what...
Patience, my dear boy, patience. All in good time. To round out the picture of the good Monsieur Bidot, and by way of background, I should perhaps mention that his Manhattan home is a Fifth Avenue apartment sprayed daily with quarts of lilac water. His wife is the former Iris Innsberg, daughter of a wealthy industrialist in the American Midwest. She stands half a head taller than her husband.
Interesting, if not particularly significant.
Now, Bidot loves expeditions. For instance, in 1930, he drove 10,000 miles across North Africa from Mombasa on the Indian Ocean, through the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, Egypt, Libya, Algeria and Morocco to Casablanca on the Atlantic.
An adventurous chap.
Yes. But what is curious, Monsieur Bidot made two trips to the same remote regions of British Columbia, Canada, one in 1926 and one in 1932.
Why?
Do you mean, why did he make the trips, or why is it curious?
Well, both, I suppose.
The answer to your second question is that it is curious, because Bidot is proposing another trip into the wilds of British Columbia, his third. As a matter of fact, he's about to start in a little over a month, June to be exact. And the answer to your first question? This is something that's been puzzling this department as well as our Canadian colleagues. And... you're the one to supply the answer.
Isn't it possible that he's just an ordinary millionaire who doesn't know how to spend his money?
Yes, quite possible. Gray, look at this map. Now then, draw an imaginary line from Edmonton in Alberta over here to Fort St. John. You're in BC now. To Fort Nelson. Got it? To White Horse in Alaska. Got it?
Yes, sir.
Now, if you in your mind extend that line, you eventually come to the Bering Straits. Right?
Right.
Now, it's not too difficult to think of that imaginary line between Edmonton and Fairbanks as a road, as a highway, is it, Gray? Now that you've got your imagination working, you might think of the Bering Straits as the back door to the USA and to Canada, to us in Great Britain, if you like.
I see.
Do you? Really? Well, in that case, it'll be a little easier for me to explain the rest. Gray, Charles Bedeau is going into that wilderness again. And both your and the Canadian government want you to join him and find out what Bedeau is up to.
I wish I had a little more to go on, sir.
Gray, isn't it enough if I tell you that Monsieur Bedeau has been seen frequently in the company of Major General Carl E. Nicholas Haushofer, the friend and mentor to Hitler in the writing of Mein Kampf?
I see. And that's why...
I made you listen to that maniac's voice tonight.
Sort of set the stage for me, sir.
In a manner of speaking, yes.
You didn't give me the same warning when you sent me into the Roman sewers a month ago.
You're going to take the boat that leaves for Halifax in 3 days. That'll give you plenty of time to get acquainted with all our files on Monsieur Bedeau. You'll dock in Halifax, Nova Scotia, then proceed by train to Montreal, where you'll be further briefed by our colleagues in the Canadian service. Then on to Toronto, and west and west again till you arrive in Edmonton in the province of Alberta. As soon as you arrive there, you'll take a room in the MacDonald Hotel and report to Bedeau.
Just like that. Report to Monsieur Bedeau.
Yes, of course. As far as he's concerned, you'll have arrived from Vancouver, British Columbia. You'll also have to be careful at the railway station. And all you'll manage, Gray. Bedeau was offered the services of a geologist by the government of British Columbia to accompany him on the trip. He accepted the offer. Hadn't much choice, I suppose, and you're it. It's your cover, Gray.
Sounds plausible enough, except...
Yeah?
I don't know the first thing about rocks, sir.
Oh, you will, Gray, you will. I'm sure you're the right man for the job. You know what they say about you in the service? They say that underneath that ice-cold exterior, there beats a heart of stone.
Senor.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I must have the wrong door.
Yes, sir.
I hope I didn't disturb anybody. I'm so sorry. My room must be along the corridor somewhere.
Who is it, Horatio?
Oh, it's all right, Donna Vittorio. It's only a mistake.
Wait a minute, Horatio.
I think I'd better just...
Is there anything I can do for you?
It's all right, madam. As I explained to your maid, I must have mistaken my room.
Do you always knock on the door of your own room before you enter?
To tell you the truth, madam, I was looking for Monsieur Bidault's suite.
Monsieur Bidault's suite. In that case, you didn't make a mistake after all. This is a part of his suite. Won't you step in? Come in, please, Mr.
Gray. John Gray. Thank you very much.
My name is Vittoria Della Vigna.
When you're in this business, you match a name and a profession with a face and a body. Madame Della Vigna was described in my files as an expert female big game hunter of Swiss-Italian origin. Female, she most certainly was. But a big game hunter? With those eyes, that neck, those legs. I looked into the room again and I thought, I suppose it depends on the kind of game she was hunting.
Whiskey?
Please.
Salute.
Chin chin.
You're English?
In a way, yes. Years ago. I live in Vancouver now.
You are not, by any chance, the British Columbia geologist man.
As a matter of fact, I am.
Oh, but how very delightful.
Really?
Yes, because we'll be seeing a lot of each other, you and I.
Oh?
You are coming on a trip with us, aren't you?
Well, if you're referring to Monsieur Bidault's expedition, then yes, I am.
How very charming. While I go off hunting mountain goats, you can come with me and show me some rocks. It will be such fun.
Madam, I'll be only too delighted.
Vittoria.
Oh, Charles, Charles, dear, our rock man has just arrived. Isn't he a pet?
There was no mistaking Charles F. Bidault. This time I did not make a mistake. Junkie, 5'6", around 50, a close-cropped bullet head. The files said that he had a passion for women, expensive clothes, fine foods, and wine. If these passions had wrought any ravages on the man, then they certainly did not show on his leathery features.
Monsieur Gray?
Yes, sir.
Ah, I was expecting you. You were just in time. We start the day after tomorrow. I expect you brought your gear with you?
Yes, sir. It was on the train with me from Vancouver.
Good. Now, tomorrow night, I am going to hold a final briefing of all those taking part in my expedition. It will be held right here in the hotel. There you will get your final instructions. Right now, I am holding a press conference in the main salon of the hotel, attended by some of the more prominent citizens of Edmonton and other members of the public. Publicity never hurt anyone, eh, Gray?
No, sir, I suppose not, though being a geologist, I don't know very much about it.
Anyway, if you care to come along, you might be able to pick up a few pointers. I don't suppose your office in Vancouver has given you too much information.
No, sir. I know the territory you're going into, and that's about all.
Good. Now, if you come along, we'll give you a little more.
Arrivederci, Signor Gray. And remember, I expect you to show me lots and lots of rocks.
The purpose of the expedition, sir?
Yeah, that's a good question.
The purpose of our expedition is to penetrate the vast area between the Canadian Rockies, the Cassiar, and the Siskiyou Mountains, just south of the Yukon, which has never been explored, and to record valuable geographical
geological and meteorological data concerning this area. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to meet the... just a moment, please. Another member of our expedition has just arrived. Monsieur Gray, would you be good enough to join us at the table? Over here, Mr. Gray. Ah. Now that we are all here, allow me to introduce to you the key personnel and members of my expedition. Ladies, first. My wife, Madame Bedeau. Madame la Contessa, Vittoria Della Vigna. The renowned Italian big game hunter.
Madame Della Vigna's outfit bore resemblance to the Bersaglieri's. The Italian mountain troops with high boots and feathered hat.
Fraulein Lottie Herman, our cameraman. Or, should I say, camera woman. And official photographer.
Chiefly occupied with making propaganda films for Hitler. Technically excellent, psychologically dangerous. I noted that he hadn't mentioned Rocio, the maid.
Monsieur Jean Gray, geologist and seconded to the expedition by the government of British Columbia. Thank you. Robert McBride, my game steward.
McBride was the game warden in Bedeau's French chateau.
Charles Montand from Paris, France, a representative of the Citroën Company and mechanical engineer in charge of the trucks.
It can't be done, Buster.
Did I hear a voice of doubt from over there?
You sure did, mister.
Well, I will tell you something, monsieur. It is fun to do things others call impossible. And if you, monsieur, care to find out how it's done, you are invited to join my crew. What is your name?
It's Charles Evans. But folks around here and in the bush call me Indian Charlie.
Hey, Charlie.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Evans.
Oh, nobody's called me Mr. Evans in donkey's years, Mr. What's your name? It can't be done. But I'd sure like to join you.
Bedeau continued to introduce the other members of his crew. His valet, Kurt Tagenbach, looked more like a professional bouncer or bodyguard. For a valet, I thought he had a lot of jewelry.
What is the purpose of the expedition, sir?
The purpose of our expedition is to penetrate the vast area between the Canadian Rockies, the Cassiar, and the Siskiyou Mountains, just south of the Yukon, which has never been explored, and to record valuable geographical, geological, and meteorological data concerning this area.
Why?
Ours is decidedly not an expedition of gold seekers. We shall, however, follow the suggestion of the British Columbia Department of Mines and examine carefully such botolitic outcroppings as we may encounter. There is, of course, the possibility that we may make an important discovery of minerals.
Don't you think you're taking on a heck of a lot, mister?
I think that dodging Canadian mosquitoes and black flies in the north and spending much of the next few months up above the snow line in the Rockies will be pleasanter than the 9,000-mile trip I made across Africa a few years ago. It will be cooler anyway.
Why the tractors if you have the horses?
Because I think I am doing something for Canada by taking the machines on this trip. We shall have to build roads as we go.
Can be done.
It will open up an entirely new stretch of country in the mountains and people. People can follow and settle there. Besides, we go halfway to Great Slave. And I believe that our road may be continued all the way by one of the governments, so that radium ores that may be there can be brought out by tractor.
And if you don't get the tractors through,
then we will leave them and go by horse. And if we are stuck with those, then I will radio for an airplane and fly the rest of the way. I'm taking a radio set with me for emergencies.
What exactly is your route?
Edmonton, Fort Saint-Jean, Bear Flat, Prophet River, Red Fern Lake, Sifton Pass, Deese Lake, Telegraph Creek.
Oh, say, brother, you're wasting a lot of time fooling around with them fancy cayuses and tanks and all this fuss and feathers.
That's right.
Why don't you take the train to Prince Rupert and catch the steamer? Telegraph Creek, right on a steamboat run, and a no-account place at that. Now, this way you'll land nowhere, and it's going to cost you plenty.
I started loading the tractors the next day. I went over to supervise the loading of my equipment, which had been sent up from Vancouver. Indian Charlie, who by now was a member of the official party, though God knows in what capacity, sat on a log chewing tobacco.
Pretty fancy, eh, Mr. Gray?
Indian Charlie's remark seemed to me a decided understatement. There were fireproof tents woven out of asbestos fiber, folding aluminum tables, chairs, beds, baths, washbowls and bush toilets, silver cutlery, crystal stemware, fancy French cooking pots, rugs, cushions, mosquito nets and serving trays. The victuals included cases of champagne, still wines, pâté de foie gras, and canned or bottled French delicacies, ranging from truffles to chicken livers. The clothing for the dough and the women of the party included silk pajamas, tropical weight shirts, cashmere sweaters, fur parkas, and quilted pants. For relaxation, there were several hundred pounds of French literature. Some of it a bit risque. Each of the tractors sagged under a weight of more than 8,000 pounds.
What's it all about, Mr. Gray?
Well, you heard Mr. Bedore last night, Charlie. Why ask me?
Well, mister, you look like a guy with his head screwed on right. I guess I thought you had the answer to their crazy goings-on. Look at that stuff. Myself, I never slept in one of them beds in my life. Won't touch some chicken livers, though. Booze looks all right. Plenty of it. Wait till the Indians catch sight of that lot. The women folks okay, too. Especially that Italian lady. Asked me about trapping last night.
What do you think of the tractors, Charlie?
And that's another thing, Mr. Gray. Supposing they got those big cats 300 or more miles back in the bush. What of it? They'd only be stuck there till horses got the party out. Here comes the boss. Morning, boss.
Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Mr. Gray.
Good morning, sir.
All loaded up, Gray?
Just about, I think.
Got everything you need?
Yes, they've sent everything up from Vancouver.
Well, the tractors can take everything. I've had them specially designed. They're all-purpose vehicles. Tractor, truck, automobile, all in one.
You think they'll make it over that terrain, sir?
Everyone says it can't be done. To take a fleet of automobiles through the unmapped Rockies. I say it can. The government hasn't much faith in me. But I've done the impossible before.
Which government are you speaking of, sir?
Why, your government, of course. Or the United States government. Any government, as a matter of fact.
next morning, after a champagne breakfast attended by distinguished citizens of Edmonton, the convoy ground up Jasper Avenue through cheering crowds and camera flashbulbs, stopped at Government House to hear a farewell speech by Alberta's governor, and plunged down into the mud of the improved highway that led north for 550 miles to Fort St. John. With frequent stops to swill mud out of clogged tracks, the tractors struggled onward at an average speed of 4 miles an hour.
Dan. See what the banners say, Charlie?
Can't read, Mr. Gray.
Well, it spells Bon Voyage and Viva Bedeau. Looks like the whole population is out waving tricolor flags.
Message was relayed to Bedeau, who rode up to the head of the convoy. 2,000 people waiting to stage a rodeo for Bedeau. He couldn't resist that. With a small retinue, he rode down the bush trail while we waited. It didn't really take long before he came back. Angry. Very angry. The drunk was gone. Breakdown became more frequent as rain and wind lashed the caravan. Gumbo threw off tracks, choked feed pipes and gummed up transmissions, differentials and brake drums. Bedeau began to show flashes of caprice. At Tupper Creek, where the expedition bogged down for 48 hours, he flung himself under a tractor and helped clean out the mud. On emerging, he found Jack Moore, a young student who had got a job on the expedition at the last moment, surrounded by admiring girls. The girls giggled at Bedeau's bedraggled appearance. Bedeau fired Moore on the spot. Those snorting tractors continued to wallow through the wilds, and the guards looked down and laughed, tossing obstacle after obstacle in their paths. The floodgates of heaven opened and turned placid streams into raging torrents.
Well, what now, Mr. Gray?
Patience, Charlie. Patience. The sands of the desert didn't stop the governor. There's no reason why the halfway river should, even if it is flooding its banks.
but I can't swim, Mr. Gray.
I think we're about to get our instructions, Charlie.
Attention, everybody. According to information received before we left Edmonton, this river is ordinarily fordable, but heavy rains have converted it into a raging torrent. Now, we've got no time to waste. I want all hands to build a raft. A great big raft, starting now.
And a raft they built. It was built of 30-foot logs and decorated with bloated rubber pontoons.
What do you think, Gray?
A bit risky, sir.
I don't think so. The raft looks practically unsinkable to me.
What do you intend to do?
Ferry the whole lot across.
And the women?
Including the women. And the tractors.
What about the horses?
They will have to swim across.
Well, I suppose you know what you're doing.
You bet I do, Mr. Gray. You bet I do.
First came the head wrangler. He stood on the edge of the pontoon, straining at the rope that held the logs to the huge Douglas fir tree. Then the Countess, her black boots splattered with mud. Rocio, the maid, was right behind her, carrying what looked like a makeup case. She was followed by Bedeau's huge valet, who held a black box under his arm. I had noticed that box before. It was the size of a shoebox, and it was never out of reach of Kurt Hagenbach. It was obviously made of steel and was covered with what looked like black webbing. That box interested me. I had a feeling that it contained more than the Bedeau's dancing pumps. I made my way back to the river and jumped onto the raft. Then the first tractor rumbled on and was secured to the logs by chains. We all stood up to our knees in water. If it reached my armpits, my gun would get wet.
Hold on to you, Mr. Gray.
Not at all. Help yourself, madam.
You always look so resourceful, Mr. Gray. I feel safe in your company.
She put her arm around my waist and held on. The bride stood by the big Douglas fir, a double-edged axe in his hand. The only sound came from the river. As if witnessing our own execution, we watched McBride slowly raise the axe. I looked around. Kurt's eyes had become little slits, and his fingers were white around the box. The Countess buried her head in my shoulder. Her hair smelled of rain and pitch and expensive perfume. A couple of the cowboys crossed themselves. The others stopped chewing their tobacco. And now the axe came down. I held forward like a bullet and smashed against the side of the tractor. Blinded by water, I gripped one of the links of the chain that held the tractor to the careening raft. Countess was thrown forward and she held on to me for dear life. And I felt her hand slip inside my coat. Without letting go of the chain, I wrenched my body sideways. She gave a terrible cry and slumped onto the logs. By now, we were caught in a whirlpool. I could see nothing but sheets of water before my eyes and the grossly distorted faces of the other passengers. It was like looking into the rotating, wet carnival mirrors. Suddenly, I saw the black box shoot across the raft. It traveled between two logs like a child's little electric train on rails. Let go of the chain, pitched forward, fell on my face and slid towards the box. As I reached out for it, I felt a terrible blow on the back of my head, and the whole world became black.
Why do you carry a gun, Mr. Gray?
are you talking about?
Why, you, of course. Our government geologist.
What happened?
It was very unfortunate. The raft got caught in one of the whirlpools, and that was the end of it. We lost the truck. But you were really the hero of this unfortunate occurrence. And I haven't had the opportunity of thanking you, Mr. Gray.
Thank me? For what?
You saved some very valuable possessions of mine. Most self-sacrificing of you.
What are you talking about? I have a terrible headache, and I'm not in the mood for riddles.
I'm talking about that little black box. The way you dived for it. Admirable. It's too bad one of the chain links had to hit you on the back of your head.
Chain link? Are you sure it was a chain link?
What else, Mr. Gray? But now, I must let you rest. You deserve it. We'll continue our trip tomorrow. And we must get you fit. Who knows? We might need your heroic efforts very soon again.
Mr. Gray. Mr. Gray. Don't try to move. It's me, Mr. Gray. Rocio. Rocio the maid.
Yes. It's an odd time to go visiting. What do you want?
Don't talk loud. I don't want anybody to hear us.
I'm afraid... Oh, no. Not tonight, Rocio.
Oh, it's not what you think, Mr. Gray. Not at all. Well, I'm sure Mr. Ramsey will be amused at the first thought that came into your head.
Well, I'll be damned.
Exactly. Mr. Gray, listen, we haven't much time. I've got to be brief. I'm not Spanish, and as you've probably gathered by now, I'm not a maid. We are colleagues, at least on the job. I'm Portuguese, and as such, an old ally of Britain. Our respective departments collaborate occasionally, although this is not known generally. Political considerations, I suppose. Mr. Beto has bought up a lot of land in Portugal recently, and my government would like to know why.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a geologist from Vancouver, and I don't...
Oh, if your Mr. Ramsey chose not to tell you about me, then he must have had a good reason for it. But you've got to take my word, whether you like it or not. Look, you are alive. That should be proof enough.
What do you mean?
After you made that elegant tackle for the boss, our friend Kurt dived forward. It looked as if he was trying to save you. But instead, he grabbed hold of the box with one hand, and with the other, he hit you on the back of your head with a heavy span. The rest of us were thrown off the raft at the same time. I saw what happened. I dived under the surface and swam in your direction. I got hold of you, and under the cover of a floating log, I got you to the opposite bank. Then I walked back up the river. A couple of the cowboys brought you back to camp later on. You were unconscious.
What about Kurt and Bedeau?
I haven't seen Kurt, but Bedeau was most solicitous.
Do you think he suspects?
That's what I like to know. Because if he does, my plans must be changed. We don't even know what we're looking for.
It's that black box I keep thinking about. He said he had some valuable possessions in it.
His wife's jewelry or...
Oh...
All the kind of possessions Mr. Ramsey would like to hear about. Goodbye, Mr. Gray. And the next time we meet by moonlight again, I hope the circumstances will be more favorable. You and I may be in the Secret Service, but there's nothing secret about your reputation, Mr. Gray.
McBride.
Oh, good morning, sir.
How would you like to get Mr. Gray and me a drink? Champagne, please.
I've got it right here, sir. Here you are, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, McBride.
Yes, sir.
I think you had better check to see if my wife is ready. It seems that Mr. Gray and some of the hands are getting impatient. We'll be leaving shortly.
Yes, sir.
Cheers, Mr. Gray.
Cheers.
Ah. There are some people who might say it's a bit too early for a drink. Yeah, but it's a good way to start the day in the bush. Now, Mr. Gray, let's get down to brass tacks. I don't think the B.C. Department of Mines would like to hear that instead of a microscope, all you handled was a gun, eh? After all, this is a scientific expedition. Look, Gray, I don't know what you're up to, but whatever it is, I don't like it. I've got a lot of money tied up in this expedition. All I get out of it is kicks. But it might be of great future benefit to the British, American, and Canadian governments. Your government, Gray, which pays your salary as a geologist. And it is as a geologist that you are with me on this trip. Remember that. If it is amorous adventure you're after on this trip, there are plenty of squash in the bush. Now, do we understand each other, Mr. Gray?
Perfectly, sir.
In that case, we'd better start. Oh, and Gray, I suggest you do not forget our little chat. I don't like to repeat myself.
Yeah, it's me. Who's you go? Hello.
The country now is getting wilder, a land with valleys heavy in muskeg. We continued through this for several days. Constant travel through mud afflicted the horses with a disease known as hoof rot, and almost every day one, two, or three had to be shot. Their burdens were distributed among the remainder. Although much kit was dumped, Bedeau wouldn't sacrifice any of his personal comforts. It took two horses to carry the women's clothes and several more to carry the wines. One afternoon, the head wrangler insisted that the loads be lightened. Bedeau agreed to jettison hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Instead of dumping the boxes, however, he ordered the men to fire the bullets in the air. It must have taken them several hours.
You know, Mr. Gray...
Yes, Charlie?
Them guys went plumb crazy. Bet them Indians back at the reservation must have thought old Chief Joseph rides again. Drink, Mr. Gray.
Yeah, thank you.
What the hell is that stuff? I was getting tired of that bubble stuff old Bedeau hands out every night. I know a couple of guys back there on that reservation. They got a nice little still on the place. Rode back last night while you was all sleeping and got myself a crock.
You know this country pretty well, don't you, Charlie?
Oh, like the back of my hand. Oh, all this fuss they're making. Blah, tractors. This is horse country. And you don't want to load them down, no, sir, like he does. That's why we're running all this trouble. Oh, I'd sure like to know what the hell he's doing out in the bush anyway.
Oh, so would I, Charlie.
Rappers like me, traders, Indians, they come into this part of the country all the time. All they carry is a cayuse, a few traps, and a rifle, maybe. And they think no more of it than you city guys going to the corner store for groceries. Don't get all that fuss they make in the papers about it.
Charlie, could you use a few dollars?
Me, Mr. Gray? Could I use a few bucks? I could always use a few bucks. Why do you think I'm on this damn trip? For my health? I could be sitting in Edmonton in the McDonald bar, drinking decent rye, instead of working with a crazy guy who... don't know what to do with his money. What do I have to do for it, Mr. Gray?
Ride back to Edmonton.
Ride back to...
Yes. And take a parcel back there for me.
Parcel?
Yes, a small black box, actually. About the size of a shoebox.
Well, that ain't hard, I guess.
I don't know about that.
What do I do when I get to Edmonton?
You take the box to the RCMP office and hand it to Sergeant O'Neill. He'll know what to do with it.
Well, now, ain't that a coincidence, Mr. Gray? Sergeant O'Neill and me are old buddies. The first still I ever operated in the bush. Let me see now, when was it? I can't remember now. Anyway, it was years ago. Sergeant O'Neill was a rookie then. It was him who found it and put his damned axe to it. It was his first job. We've been buddies ever since.
Well, in that case, he'll be glad to see you. After you deliver the box, you go back to the McDonald and wait for me. You can wait in the bar.
In the bar, Mr. Gray? Why, it might be days, weeks, before you get out of the bush.
That's right. You just sit in that bar and order anything you like. Tell the bartender to put it on my bill.
Days? Weeks? Where is that box, Mr. Gray?
I don't know. Though I have a pretty good idea.
You mean you
gotta pinch it first.
Pinch it? I trust you, all right, Mr. Gray. But will O'Neill trust me?
I'll give my word, Charlie. You'll be all right.
Okay, Mr. Gray. If you say so.
That night we made camp under some tall timber. It had stopped raining. The night was magnificent. A full moon was shining through the branches of the firs, and the walls of the tents glowed like paintings on velvet. This was the Far West I'd heard about but never believed in. Bedeau's tent was unmistakable. An elaborate pennant with an obviously phony crest was fastened to the roof. Madame Bedeau's tent had pink roses painted all over it. Bedeau's bar was pushed hard against the side of one of the tents. That identified it as McBride's. And that's where the little black box was kept. The party around the campfire was getting livelier. Obviously, Bedeau had broken out another case of champagne for the boys. I stood under a tall fir, pressed hard against its trunk.
Like a branch of the old tree himself?
Listen, Matthew, I need your help. You've got to get hold of that box.
McBride's tent, under his cot, padlock.
How did you know that?
Oh, Mr. McBride may be a Scot, but he's very generous with his liquor.
I've still got to get that damn box. Tonight.
That shouldn't be too difficult.
What?
I have a date with Mr. McBride.
You know, Rocio, I have a feeling that old Ramsey would appreciate you.
Oh, I know he would. He asked me to work for him. But I think I'll stay in Portugal. The London fog, you know.
Now's the time.
Yes, I'll stroll over to the fire. McBride is waiting for me.
Later on in the night, I skirted the ground. McBride and Lucio had gone to join the others at the fire. I unfastened the bottom part of the tent flap. From my position on the ground, I could see the box under the cot. I inched my way across the tent floor and pulled the box out. Yes, it was padlocked all right. There was no sense in trying to break the lock open now. There was no time, and it was too dangerous. I picked up the box and crawled back outside the tent. I stood up, and with the box under my arm, ran across the clearing.
Gray, I need you. There's been an accident.
Accident?
Yes, a nasty one, I'm afraid. As the official geologist, you are the only government representative here. I need you as a witness.
Witness?
Yes. Nasty, isn't it?
Indian Charlie.
I want you to have a good look at him, Gray. We'll have to make a report of this accident to the police when we get back.
What makes you so sure it was an accident, Mr. Bedeau?
What else could it have been, Gray? Kurt, my valet, found him on the bottom of a gorge, not 10 miles away from here.
And what was your valet doing 10 miles from camp in the middle of the night? Gathering mushrooms for breakfast?
It was I who sent Kurt out riding down that trail.
Why?
Because when McBride came back to his quarters, he found something missing. This box. When we checked the camp for any missing men, we found Indian Charlie gone. I took a chance and ordered Court to ride in the direction from which we came. After about 10 miles, he saw a horse by the side of the trail, grazing on some bushes. Below the trail was a deep, rocky gorge. At the bottom of it was Charlie, his head split open by a rock. I almost forgot. This box, my property, was fastened to the saddle of his horse.
Mr. Bedeau, if I'm to witness this accident, what is it that Charlie tried to steal?
Ah, I was wondering when you'd ask me that. It is my wife's jewelry, of course. We never go on any of our trips without a couple of diamond tiaras, at least.
We buried Charlie about an hour later, continued on what I started to call our champagne safari. But that morning, the wine started turning sour for me. At last, we reached the lonely Hudson Bay post at Whitewater. Only 80 of the original 130 head of horses were fit to be loaded. The mired tractors were useless. Bedeau looked around and surveyed his bedraggled crew and useless equipment. Then he announced to his assembled crew that he had decided not to continue with his plans to reach Telegraph Creek. Had he already accomplished what he had intended? Had he abandoned his plan, or was it all really the whim of a crazy millionaire? Bedeau now sent some men down the river to rent powerboats and bring them up to Whitewater. The remaining horses were turned loose. They were doomed to die of starvation soon. At Taylor Flats, Bedeau rented trucks and taxis, which took us to the railroad station. Here, Bedeau paid off the cowboys, and only his closest retinue and I continued by train to Edmonton. On arrival in Edmonton, I immediately went to see Sergeant O'Neill. He handed me a message from Ramsey, ordering me to return to London after making a preliminary report to RCMP headquarters in Ottawa. It was time to say goodbye to the big white hunter and return to London.
Interesting, Gray. Very interesting indeed.
Ah. Scotch tastes good after my champagne safari.
And the trophy, a little black box. Now, please observe the black markings which form a line from Edmonton to Fairbanks, Alaska. And this map over here is a secret document supplied to our Canadian and American colleagues. It traces a proposed military highway which is to run from Edmonton to Fairbanks, Alaska. In times of war like this, let me be fanciful and call it Alaska Highway, would be invaluable as a supply route. And considering the political situation in Europe at the present time, His Majesty's government has decided interest in the undisturbed start and the eventual completion of such a project. There's nothing we could possibly do to Monsieur Bedeau now, but I promise you that from now on we'll keep an eye on him.
How did you get that box with the map?
Just a minute, please. Miss DeLeon.
All right, Mr. Gray. Here it is. After you left us in Edmonton, we stayed on for a couple of days. With the help of Sergeant O'Neill, I had an identical black box made. Having established friendly relations with McBride, I was able to exchange the two identical boxes. I took the original to O'Neill, who expertly picked the lock and photocopied the maps in it. Then I simply replaced the box again and removed the empty one. McBride was too preoccupied with his bottles and his ballads to notice.
Busy little girl,
aren't
you?
No, Gray, you've done your share. The whole assignment is simply a classic example of perfect international cooperation.
Thank you, sir.
As a matter of fact, we've just heard that Signor Mussolini has certain plans for the African continent. I'd like to suggest that you, Mr. Gray, and Miss DeLeon, take a look and see what's going on there. Sort of African safari, I'd say.
Mr. President, the African war is over. One continent, at least, has been cleansed and purged forever from fascist or Nazi tyranny. The proud German army has met by sudden collapse, sudden crumbling and breaking up, unexpected. To all of us, the proud German army has won.
Fascinating story, Mr. Gray.
Yes, all those memories stirred up by this old tractor in a Saskatoon museum. But I must be on my way to Edmonton.
Oh, just a minute, Mr. Gray. You do have a little time. What happened to Bideau in the end?
We never did find out completely. He had excellent connections. He lent his chateau in France to a member of the royal family who married his American fiancée there. Later, he rented a house near Hitler's retreat at Vector's Garden and had many meetings with Schacht, the Nazi financial wizard. When war broke out, Bideau helped in the negotiations between Pierre Laval, the head of the Vichy government, and the Nazis. During the war, he lived in great luxury in Algiers. When Darlin was assassinated there, he was arrested and shortly afterwards turned up in Miami, Florida, where he was arrested again for alleged passport violations. The Attorney General was prepared to seek federal grand jury indictments charging Bideau with treason when, on February 19th, 1944, he died by taking an overdose of sleeping tablets. So, you see, we'll never really know the full story.
But we do know that the Alaska Highway was built, Mr. Gray. Brother, I don't know what to say. To think that that old truck in the back... And you turning up here like that? The Portuguese lady? Old Charlie?
Well, Mr. Rogers, shall we call it ancient history? And now I really better be going. My Canadian holiday is nearly over, and my wife will be waiting for me at the airport in London. Now that I've retired, we're spending our winters in Lisbon. It's warmer there. And besides, it's where she was born.
You have been listening to Champagne Safari, written especially for Mystery Theater by Otto Lowy. The cast, John Gray, Colin Gorey. Bideau, Russ Waller. Rothio, Marion Waldman. Ramsey, William Seller. Indian Charlie, Jack Anthony. McBride, William Krawitz. Bruce, Earl Golden. Technical operation, Stan Evanishin. Sound effects, Ron Pambrun. Champagne Safari was produced and directed in the CBC's Winnipeg studios by Tony Ross. By the way, one of the Citroën trucks is preserved in Saskatoon's Western Development Museum. The producer is indebted to curator George Shepherd for whetting his curiosity. Norm Micklewright speaking. This is the CBC Radio Network.